This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Welcome to the Massachusetts State House News Service, providing our listeners with high-quality, comprehensive, objective information about the activities of our state government. Today, we are covering the week of July 27th through August 2nd, 2026. This program is sponsored by the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind. This is Paula Simchak. The House's healthcare point person was not picked to participate in Primary Care Reform Conference Committee talks, defying the expected assignment and suggesting some tension in House leadership ranks. Representative John Lawn, co-chair of the Healthcare Financing Committee, also did not deliver floor remarks Thursday on the House bill that maps out a longer runway to reach primary care spending target. Lawn also did not appear with House Speaker Ron Mariano and Ways and Means Chair Aaron Michlewitz after a post-caucus scrum Thursday afternoon. The House negotiators are Representatives Michlewitz, Megan Kilcoyne, and Hannah Kane. The news service asked Mariano's office why Lawn was not tapped for the panel. Amidst the Trump administration's sweeping health care cuts and the need for the broader health care system to refocus its spending on primary care, Chair Michlewitz's experience dealing with fiscal policy makes him the ideal member to lead the House during this conference committee process, Mariano said. Kilcoyne is vice chair of the HCF committee, and her biomarker insurance coverage policy made it into the mega amendment to the House bill. Kane is the ranking minority member of the panel, and she delivered a synopsis of the legislation Thursday. Senator Cindy Friedman, Lawn's HCF committee counterpart, is the lead negotiator on the Senate side for the primary care reform. The other Senate conferees are Senator John Cronin and Minority Leader Bruce Tarr, after Republican Representative Kelly Dooner was briefly appointed and then resigned from the assignment. Aides to Mariano and Lawn did not answer news service questions about why the Watertown Democrat did not give remarks on the major health care bill. In a rare moment Wednesday, Mariano was at the rostrum as the House, without discussion, adopted a Lawn amendment dealing with the laws governing child sex abuse. Lawn declined to speak to the news service outside the House chamber Friday afternoon before the conferees were announced. "I'm not making any comments right now," Lawn said. "I have a meeting. I have people waiting in my office." Governor Maura Healey talked to legislative energy affordability bill negotiators Thursday and sent them a letter on Friday urging swift action to resolve differences in House and Senate bills that are very different. Healey, who has spoken for more than a year about her energy agenda after filing a bill in May 2025, railed on utility companies during a State House press conference 2 days after conferees tasked with hashing out the legislation met for the first time. The governor's office announced at 10:16 a.m. Friday that Healey would host a press conference that afternoon, where her office distributed a letter she sent to the energy chairs and she talked about her energy affordability priorities. "When it comes to utility companies, we've got to end business as usual. Utility companies are seeking rate hikes and excessive profits, while people and businesses are struggling to pay their bills," Healey said, outlining the contents of her four-page letter to Representative Mark Cusack and Senator Mike Barrett. Healey said she supports provisions to modernize procurement policies, accelerate new energy resource development, and lower the cost of electricity. She said Friday that among a slate of other policies, she wants to change how utilities buy their energy, a full audit of utilities companies, and to end sweetheart deals that enable a profit bonus for being part of New England's grid. "We've talked to them a lot over the last, well, several months," Healey told reporters when asked whether she had talked to Cusack and Barrett about the letter. "I talked to all of them as recently as yesterday. We're going to keep talking because I think we all recognize how important it is that we get this done and that we take the actions that we can take to lower people's energy bills." But Healey, who has taken heat from political opponents who say her energy policies are contributing to rising costs, isn't the only one pitching lawmakers. While Eversource supports an affordability focus and an all-of-the-above energy approach to address supply constraint issues, at the same time we must recognize that the lack of baseload supply causes the region to burn millions of gallons of oil during times of peak demand, adding billions in costs for customers across New England and significantly increasing carbon emissions to the environment, Eversource spokesperson William Hinkle said. It is also important to note that increased investments in utility infrastructure will be necessary to support the Commonwealth's goals, such as bringing more solar online and strengthening demand response programs, Hinkle continued. The Mass Coalition for Sustainable Energy on Thursday wrote a letter to Cusack, Barrett, and other members of the committee urging them to prioritize energy affordability and to refrain from adding new costs to already record-high energy bills. The coalition's letter opposed efforts to create or expand incremental programs that will add costs, sunset GSEP, terminate the requirement that utilities must serve natural gas to customers that choose it, and securitize clean energy costs. Should the product of this conference report fail to lower ratepayer bills or put the reliability and safety of our energy infrastructure at risk, we would urge conferees to table any energy legislation until next session, the coalition, which includes some labor unions and business groups, wrote. On the same afternoon that the governor was railing against utility companies, including a specific reference to Berkshire Gas, her Department of Public Utilities approved a settlement that would allow Berkshire Gas to increase its gas-based distribution rates to generate approximately $18.5 million in additional revenues, down from the $28 million the company requested. The new rates are effective Saturday. The department has considered the estimated bill impacts associated with the settled rate increase. The department is mindful of the burdens associated with higher bills and recognizes that the magnitude of the proposed rate increase, even as reduced in the settlement agreement, is significant, the DPU order said. We also acknowledge that the department must ensure that the rates we approve today are sufficient to ensure the financial viability of the company, without which it cannot serve its customers. In doing so, the department must balance the concerns of customers, the utilities who serve them, public officials, and other regulatory bodies, summed up in our goal of providing safe and reliable service at the lowest possible cost. National Grid Director of Strategic Communications for Corporate Affairs New England, Brendan Moss, said Friday that any final legislation should focus on measures that provide real, measurable affordability benefits for customers while preserving the investments necessary to maintain a safe and reliable energy system that drives our economy and maintaining customer choice. Approaches that simply shift costs to future customers, defer essential infrastructure work, remove customer choice, or repackage costs without reducing them will not deliver meaningful affordability. Massachusetts households pay some of the highest energy costs in the country, and lawmakers have pointed to billions of long-term savings that would come as a result of their energy proposals. The House passed its energy bill in February, proposing to cut the Mass Save program by $1 billion, and the Senate passed its own on July 1st, proposing instead to phase out the Gas System Enhancement Program. Asked Friday which version of the bill she'd sign, Healy said, "Let's see what I get, and let's see how this process goes," noting that she's concerned about utility profits when it comes to the GSEP program. Healy also said that she thinks Mass Save is something that should be reformed and that she is called to cap spending on the program, but that is a program that's been around for a while. It's played an important role. Cusack said on Wednesday that there are a lot of agreements and significant disagreements, as we know, and I look forward to working through those with some urgency to try to get relief to our constituents, the households, and businesses before this winter. Barrett added, "We should do this ideally before a November election, so that those of us who have races can point to an achievement." Asked what she makes of lawmakers pushing lawmaking past July 31 and into campaign season under new joint rules, Healy said, "I don't think about it in terms of a campaign schedule." As to whether she has any indication of whether lawmakers are close to an agreement on energy, Healy said, "Well, they're meeting. The good news is the conference committee met the other day. That was for the first time, and they've got, you know, a lot of work ahead." Healy was also asked about the potentially tumultuous nature of the relationship between energy chairs and her strategy for getting them together and getting a bill to her desk before November. Healy replied, "I don't accept any characterizations about members of the legislature." She did not stop to answer a question about whether she had spoken to House Speaker Ron Mariano or Senate President Karen Spilka on Friday, or if she planned to visit them. After an abortion care bill skirted his committee, Senate Ways and Means Chair Michael Rodriguez voiced support for legislation on the branch's agenda Friday to remove barriers to termination after 24 weeks of gestation. "I feel very strongly that when it comes to reproductive health care, that the conversation is best between medical professionals and the patient," Rodriguez told the news service around 1 p.m. on Friday. On a 119-33 vote, the House passed the bill on July 22nd that removes the four parameters under state law that enable abortions to be performed after 24 weeks in life-threatening circumstances for the mother or fetus. The bill instead gives deference to doctors' professional judgment. Rather than heading to the Senate Ways and Means Committee after clearing the House, The bill was shuttled to the Senate Rules Committee, which pulled the measure Thursday and placed it before the full Senate on Friday. Rodriguez said he didn't know why the abortion bill did not go through his committee, which handles a wide variety of bills, is a pit stop for most legislation, and currently has more than 1,150 bills before it. It didn't have to. There's no fiscal impact, he said. The abortion bill had not surfaced in the Senate by 1:30 p.m. Friday, but an agenda posted ahead of Friday's session showed the branch not only intends to pass it Friday, but they plan to work with the House to enact the bill and send it to the governor. While it appears that lawmakers won't finish work on many major priorities of the House and Senate, Rodriguez said Friday's final scheduled formal sessions for this term was so far so good and going very smoothly. It's a much more calm and productive day than usual, Rodriguez said. The legislature on Friday sent to Governor Maura Healey's desk legislation that establishes guidelines for how schools and public libraries make decisions about the availability and appropriateness of books. Together, we are setting forth a bill to protect free expression and intellectual curiosity and every person's right to free expression. Massachusetts has long been a national leader in education and learning. We are home to the nation's first public library and first public school. In this commonwealth, we have long appreciated that unabridged access to knowledge is a key to finding opportunity and fulfillment, Senator Julian Sirr said during Thursday's Senate session when the chamber advanced the legislation. This legislation builds on that proud, long-standing tradition by ensuring that decisions about library collections are made by trained professionals through a transparent process, not by political pressure or intimidation. The bill outlines criteria for school library teachers to use while determining whether materials are appropriate for a library, including whether it is age-appropriate, serves an educational purpose, and is based on the teacher's or employee's professional training and not on personal, political, or doctrinal view. Employees responsible for library materials can still remove items that are outdated or to accommodate new items. Attempts to ban books, largely ones dealing with race, gender, and LGBTQ+ identities, have been on the rise across the country. In 2025, 4,235 different titles were challenged, second only to 2023, when there were 4,240 challenges, according to the American Library Association's Office for Intellectual Freedom, which noted that not all book challenges are reported. In 2025, 33 public libraries reported formal challenges, more than 7 years combined, to material, and 86 libraries faced a total of 3,093 informal challenges, according to the Massachusetts Board of Library Commissioners. Under the bill, materials can only be removed from a school library after a vote by the school committee or board of trustees if it's a charter school. Before that vote, there must be a public hearing and determination from a review committee that the material taken as a whole, based on clear and convincing evidence, does not have any educational, literary, artistic, personal, or social value, or is not age-appropriate. Only school employees, parents or guardians, or students enrolled in the school can lodge challenges. Students, parents, and guardians may also appeal a decision to remove materials from the library to court. Residents of the municipality where a free library is located may challenge the selection of materials, and if materials are removed, that decision can be challenged by the material's author or creator or residents of the municipality. Employees are protected from retaliation based on their selection of library materials so long as their decision was made in good faith and followed the required criteria. At a time when the loudest and most extreme voices too often dominate, this bill helps ensure that libraries will remain quiet spaces where curiosity is encouraged, knowledge is accessible, and free expression is protected across the Commonwealth. Representative John Francis Moran of Boston, House sponsor of the bill, said in a press release. The bill also directs school districts, charter schools, and local education agencies to file an annual report with Department of Elementary and Secondary Education, including information on all complaints and challenges seeking to remove or restrict materials. The Board of Library Commissioners is also required to file a similar report with the legislature. The House enacted the legislation on a 152-1 vote, and senators enacted a bill on a voice vote. Representative John Gaskey cast the sole vote against enacting the bill. Gaskey, a Carver Republican, in June spoke about his ill-fated amendment to repeal a provision shielding schools, libraries, employees, and others from being convicted for sharing materials that are harmful to minors. We know what this bill is all about, that the ideological activists have decided to attack local school boards for simply daring to protect children from state-sponsored pornography. The outcome of this vote, I know, has already been preordained by our leadership, and we know exactly what the orders have said for you guys to do," Gaskey said at the time. "But I did not run for this office to sit here quietly while the body systematically strips away parental rights and protects government employees from the very laws that every ordinary citizen must follow." Negotiators opened talks Friday on a bill that would give thousands of teachers a second chance to opt into an enhanced retirement benefit program. "Senator Joan Lovely said lawmakers all heard from our teachers from all over our districts, and I'm really pleased that we're here at this moment to be able to make things right. Teachers who were working in 2001 but did not enroll in Retirement Plus would gain a new window to opt into the program that would allow them to retire earlier. When the state introduced the option, it offered a six-month window to opt in, and many educators say they received limited or no information about it from the state, missing the opportunity to receive increased benefits in exchange for 30 years of completed service and a higher contribution rate. There are several differences negotiators will have to hammer out. Among the largest, the House version of the bill opens the eligibility window for teachers and school nurses, while the Senate proposal is limited to teachers only, and the House also offers a much more expansive deadline cutoff for the buybacks. The House would open eligibility to educators who missed the opt-in in 2001 or any time before September 1, 2025, while the Senate limits it strictly to those who missed the original six-month window. The bills also outline different processes for the new window of eligibility, with the House explicitly stating educators would have 180 days from the law's effective date to opt in, while the Senate bill says they would have any time up to June 30, 2027. The Senate is also far more precise in outlining a formula about how retroactive contributions and interest are calculated. Asked Friday about the main differences he'll have to work out with House conferees, lead Senate negotiator, Senator Michael Rodriguez, said the buyback provisions on how eligible teachers will buy back into the system that they, for one reason or another, did not enter 25 years ago. While a solution to the problem has eluded lawmakers for a year, Rodriguez said, "I think it'll be easy to work out." The House and Senate enacted legislation Friday that enables Massachusetts to take the land occupied by the under-construction Norwood Hospital by eminent domain, effectively ratcheting up the pressure for the property's owner to make a deal with a new operator before the state flexes its authority to intervene. The fact that there was a citizens group that was actively looking to negotiate it with MPT was encouraging, House Speaker Ron Mariano told reporters Thursday. But there's still the major question out there is who's going to pay to come in there and make it a hospital and run a hospital. That's going to be the challenge. We gave them the opportunity to negotiate and find someone. Now it's up to them. A vestige of the Stewart healthcare bankruptcy crisis, Norwood Hospital closed in 2020 due to catastrophic flooding. Construction of a new hospital was stalled as Stewart went bankrupt, and the property remains controlled by Alabama-based real estate investment trust, Medical Properties Trust. The bill is on its way to Governor Maura Healey's desk, and she's likely to sign it. "I'd love to see it reopen," Healey said during a radio appearance Wednesday. "I'm happy to support that legislation, which I also think says, though, you've got to find an operator. Like, you can't just take it over. You got to find a hospital system to actually run the hospital. That's not something government can do. So that's what we really, really need to see. But I sure hope we can get something back there, because, you know, the people of that area, you know, lack the hospital presence right now. And, you know, as somebody who wants to make sure that healthcare is more available and accessible, you know, I'd love to see that happen," Healey continued. The Senate passed redrafted legislation Wednesday that outlines a competitive bidding process for the Division of Capital Asset Management and Maintenance to carry out, requiring that proposals contemplate usage for healthcare purposes and only come from nonprofit buyers. DCAM would also value the property, which would then be reviewed and approved by Inspector General Jeffrey Shapiro. The bill clarifies the land taking is subject to sufficient appropriation from the legislature. The House passed a narrow eminent domain bill on July 1. Mass General Brigham walked away from negotiations earlier this year to buy the Norwood Hospital property after MPT raised its asking price from $250 million to $375 million, the Boston Globe reported. "The fact of the matter is that we wanted to send a message to the real estate company that owns the property," Mariano said. "They started to negotiate with Mass General and then came back and raised the cost of the property, so they weren't negotiating in good faith. But we wanted to make sure that they understand they have to deal with the people of that area." Senator Michael Rush, who represents the area previously serviced by Norwood Hospital, spoke from the Senate floor about the 250,000 people left without a nearby hospital when it closed. "Even though the hospital closed, these patients did not disappear," he said. They are now driving further to Brockton or Milton or Boston. They are placing a burden on already overcrowded emergency rooms and putting their health care in jeopardy for time-sensitive emergency and cardiac events. Rush said taking the property would complete many finally pushing Steward and their accomplice, Medical Property Trust, out of Massachusetts once and for all and restoring trust in the Commonwealth's health care infrastructure. The House on Friday morning gave initial approval bills mandating free insurance coverage of cancer screenings for firefighters and allowing towns to opt out of auto enrollment for school choice tuition payments. The House Ways and Means Committee had advanced the bills less than an hour before the floor votes. The screening bill has been a priority for firefighters' unions for years. The first screening should be conducted no later than 3 years after the firefighter starts the job, with subsequent screenings happening every 3 years under the bill. The screenings could cover colon, lung, bladder, oral, thyroid, skin, blood, breast, cervical, testicular, and prostate cancers. Insurers cannot subject the screenings to copays, deductible, co-insurance, or out-of-pocket expenses. Firefighters are more likely to get cancer than the general public. The Occupational Cancer Research Center attributes higher rates of sickness to greater exposure to cancer-causing hazards through inhalation of smoke, combustion byproducts, particulate matter, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, and so-called forever chemicals, PFAS, used in fire protection gear. The bill cleared the Ways and Means Committee on a 29-0 vote. Representatives Rodney Elliott, Russell Holmes, Alan Sylvia, Shina Taylor, and Samantha Montano took no action. The committee also advanced a new draft of the school choice bill on a 29-0 vote. For certain towns that don't run their own middle and high schools, which tend to largely be in more rural areas, municipalities can pay tuition to send their students to a neighboring district school. Under current law, when a student transfers into the town's elementary school through the state's school choice program, the tuition agreement extends to cover that student when they reach middle and high school age, and sending towns are still on the hook to pay even if students opt to go elsewhere for secondary school. This bill would let the town opt out of that automatic extension for school choice students. The community wouldn't be automatically obligated to pay tuition for those students to attend the partner district's middle and slash high school if they end up choosing a different path. There are only 4 towns in the state for which this bill applies, according to Representative John Barrett, who filed the original bill for which the Ways and Means draft is based. Massachusetts would create a so-called Foster Child Bill of Rights under a new child welfare compromise House and Senate negotiators agreed to on Friday. The provision lays out rights for every child in Department of Children and Families custody or care, including to safety and security, placements that prioritize relationships with relatives and frequent contact with siblings, maintaining cultural, linguistic, religious, and gender identity, regular school attendance and educational stability, timely medical care, including behavioral health care, and reasonable access to a social worker. The Bill of Rights has been a priority for Senator Jo Comerford, who herself is a parent of 2 children adopted through foster care. The compromise was filed just before 11:30 p.m. Thursday by a conference committee made up of Comerford, Senators Robin Kennedy and Patrick O'Connor, and Representatives Jay Livingstone, Judith Garcia, and Allison Sullivan Almeida. The House passed its child welfare bill on a 159-1 vote in October. The Senate passed its version unanimously in June. The bill would generally build a more comprehensive, standing, bureaucratic layer between DCF and the school system, so a social worker isn't the only person tracking a student's education. It creates a dedicated education infrastructure inside DCF, subject to appropriation. The education unit would oversee education work across the department's regional and area offices to monitor academic progress of kids in DCF custody and support social workers or educational issues, such as helping to develop individualized education plans and 504 plans. The office would also help education records move accurately when a child transfers between school districts. However, the Senate's Electronic Backpack Program, a system designed to help with the transmission of documents when students transfer, wasn't included in the compromise and will be sent to a study commission that has a year to report back. An education director would be appointed by the DCF commissioner to oversee the department's overall education policy, and the director would also appoint education specialists who are full-time DCF employees dedicated to educational stability for kids in custody. They could accompany social workers to meet with school staff, including IEP and 504 plan meetings. The bill also creates a new set of legal counsel notification requirements, setting hard deadlines for DCF to tell a child's attorney about major events in their case. The state child fatality review team would be transferred from the Office of the Chief Medical Examiner to the Office of the Child Advocate. In rebuilding the state's child death review apparatus, the language also requires the team to outline new model investigation protocols and training for the local teams below it, and publish an annual public report of its findings. The old law described the Office of the Child Advocate as independent of any supervision or control by any executive agency. A new section of this bill would replace that with much stronger language to maintain the office's independence. OCA would be an independent state agency that shall not be subject to the supervision or control of any other executive office, executive agency, commission, board, bureau, or political subdivision of the Commonwealth. One of the largest changes comes in building out the state's network of family resource centers. The bill requires the Secretary of Health and Human Services to set standards for these community-based service programs, connect the network to existing behavioral health infrastructure, local schools and state agencies, and require standardized intake screenings to determine a family's needs. A facility deemed a family resource center could then assign a case manager to high-needs families. The bill then puts up a new enforceable preference for community services. A case manager can't refer a family to juvenile court for a child requiring assistance process where parents, guardians, or school officials ask a judge for help supervising a youth aged 6 to 18 exhibiting stubborn, runaway, or truant behaviors, unless the family has exhausted all reasonably available community-based service options first. The branches are likely to pass the bill Friday, the last day of scheduled formal sessions for the year, and send it to Governor Maura Healey's desk for her review. Governor Maura Healey went west Thursday morning to announce a $93 million five-year renovation of the Mass Mutual Center in Springfield, paired with news of the AHL's Thunderbirds extending their lease there for at least five more years. Upgrades at the Downtown Civic Center, which opened as an arena in 1972 and was expanded to include convention space in 2005, will include a new jumbotron, fire sprinkler and ventilation upgrades, improved sound and lighting technology, renovated concession areas, and premium seating, the governor said. Springfield Mayor Dominic Sarno said the fan experience will be much, much better at the MassMutual Center after the state's investment. The facility hosts the minor league hockey Thunderbirds, concerts, wrestling, and more. Not that it's bad now, but it's going to be even more enhanced, the mayor said, and you cannot put a price tag on that, because when people are feeling good, and you keep it vibrant, clean, and safe, they like to spend money in your places, and that is music to my ears. So this $93 million investment by Governor Healey and her administration is so deeply appreciative. Sarno said he's been a Thunderbird season ticket holder for more than 20 years and remembers when the team would attract 2,500 to 3,000 people for a game. He said the team is now drawing about 6,200 fans every game, with 20 sellouts and a run to the conference final last season. These are smart investments. They're smart investments for the Mass Mutual Center. They're smart investments for Springfield. They're smart investments for Massachusetts. These investments are going to benefit one of this community's greatest partners. That's the Springfield Thunderbirds, who will be staying here and extending their lease for at least the next 5 years and many championships to come, Healey said. Before heading to another announcement at the CRRC Train Assembly Factory in Springfield, Healey pledged her support to the Western Massachusetts city, the state's third largest. Springfield, the heart of Western Mass, is so critical to our state's success. Okay. Understand that I understand that Springfield is so critical to our state's success, and that's why we've made an effort in making investments, continuing to make investments, in Springfield and in this area, and today is an example of that, she said. You've been listening to an episode of the Massachusetts State House News Service, a program produced by Audio Journal and sponsored by the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind. This is Paula Simchak. Thank you for listening. Stay tuned for more informative programming by Audio Journal.
This is not a public service announcement. This is a one-minute mystery.
Put on your thinking cap. Here's a math puzzle. If it takes six men 6 days to dig six holes, how long will it take one man to dig half a hole? Thank you.
here's the solution to our mystery.
There is no such thing as half a hole. A hole is a hole.
And now back to our regular programming.